Well, welcome everyone. Nice to see such a good crowd here for such an important event. My name is Alan Wolf. I'm the director of the Boise Center for Religion and American Public Life, and this is our annual Prophetic Voices lecture. And I'm really, really excited and dying with anticipation to hear what Jim Keenan will have to offer us. I wanted to ask you to turn off your cell phones. I wanted to remind you that the bookstore has a table of Father Keenan's books outside for your perusal and hopeful purchase. And also to remind you that Front Row is filming tonight's lecture and will post a video and perhaps a transcript on our website in due course. I'm not going to introduce Father Keenan. My colleague Eric Owens, who is a colleague of his in the theology department, will have that honor. So Eric, let me turn it over to you for the introduction.
Thanks, Alan, and let me add my welcome to you all this evening. Feel free to come down. There's seats available down here for those of you who are just coming in. So let me add my welcome on this evening, the occasion of our 10th annual Prophetic Voices lecture. Tonight, Father Keenan lends his own voice to the chorus of distinguished predecessors in this lecture series, which is designed to honor extraordinary people who have drawn upon the prophetic traditions of their faith communities to challenge the consciences of all who hear. Our inaugural lecturer in 2001 was Father Brian Hare, known to many of you all, who was followed by, among others, Reverend Richard Mao, Rabbi David Saperstein, Sister Helen Prejean, Reverend Peter Gomes, Abdullahi Anaim, and last year, Professor Robert P. George of Princeton. So if one can be judged by the company he keeps, Father Keenan is in good stead tonight. This is not to say, however, that being a prophetic voice is a comfortable role to play. Despite their centrality, the Jewish, Christian, and Muslim history and theology, prophets are frequently more reviled than revered among their contemporaries. And the reason is clear. Prophets dare to condemn what others cannot see, what they refuse to see, or what they take for granted. Prophets speak truth to power in forceful and sometimes shocking ways. They're passionate and partisan advocates for the peacemakers, the poor, the weak, and the hungry. They judge us and themselves by the distance we've created between the values we claim to cherish and the lives we actually lead. And Father Keenan himself is unafraid to take a prophetic stand when circumstances demand it, as has been the case with his longstanding advocacy for persons with HIV/AIDS, his work in the church on sexual ethics and on church leadership, both before and after the sex abuse crisis. And as we will hear tonight, this critique of our very conception of the university itself. Jesus says in the Gospel of Mark that prophets are without honor in their own country. But fortunately for Jim Keenan, that is not always the case. Indeed, his honors are legion, both here and abroad. He's founder's professor of theology at Boston College, where he also directs the Presidential Scholars Program. He holds degrees from Fordham University, the Weston Jesuit School of Theology, and the Gregorian University in Rome, where he took his licentiate and doctorate degrees under the care of Fathers Josef Fuchs and Klaus Demmer. A scholar of global influence, Father Keenan has held visiting academic posts or fellowships in Edinburgh, Rome, Manila, Bangalore, and Trent, and was the organizer of two enormous international conferences of Catholic theological ethicists in Padua in 2006 and in Trent this past summer. Many of you here were in attendance to that, I know. He's published hundreds of scholarly articles and is the author or editor of 16 books, including four in the past year alone. I will mention just two of these: his monumental History of Catholic Moral Theology in the 20th Century, and with Daniel Harrington, Paul and Virtue Ethics. A Jesuit since 1970, Father Keenan has shown great courage and fortitude in his personal and professional life alike. He's also a warm and generous colleague in speaking on the topic, the University in the 21st Century, thinking about ethics, persons, and dialogue. Welcome, Jim.
Thank you. Thank you. On January 6th, after 30 years of working at the university, she was suspended. In June, she lost her job. On September 15th, she was arrested and accused of embezzling about $1 million from the university. The article is laced with irony. As part of her scheme, prosecutors said, Dean Chang siphoned a $250,000 donation from a foundation into a nonprofit organization she had created ostensibly for the university, but that was, in fact, her own personal piggy bank. The Queens District Attorney characterized Ms. Chang's actions as a betrayal that, quote, could have a chilling effect on the schools. As Dean of the Institute of Asian Studies, Dean Chang had the authority to grant 15 scholarships a year. The recipients, most of whom were from overseas, were told they had to work 20 hours a week under her supervision. The students thought they'd be doing work related to the university. Instead, according to the prosecutors, she forced them to perform menial tasks in her home in Jamaica Estates. In two accounts, one student had to take Ms. Chang's son, Stephen, to the airport at 3 a.m. Another had to deliver cash to her at Foxwoods Resort Casino in Connecticut. She made it clear that if the students did not perform their extracurricular duties, they would lose their scholarships, which were worth at least $5,000. The loss of the scholarships might have forced some of the students to drop out. Quote, after the arraignment, Ron Rubenstein, one of Ms. Chang's lawyers, said that the students' duties were a normal part of the St. John's work-study program. Many of those tasks were to help with Taiwanese dignitaries visiting Ms. Chang's house. Mr. Rubenstein said, cooking a meal doesn't sound at first blush like work-study, but wait till the trial. I'm not going to give you the defense right now. Let's move now to university athletics. Last month, again, it was so nice that these articles were just leaping from the newspapers. But on October 30th, the Chronicle for Higher Education published an essay entitled, Faculty Reps Botch Sports Oversight Role. The accounts raised worries that faculty reps are getting too close to teams they are supposed to oversee. At the University of Southern California, a faculty athletics representative shared blame as sports agents purportedly transferred more than $100,000 in cash and benefits to two star athletes. A professor at Indiana University, Purdue University, Indianapolis, improperly certified the academic eligibility for nearly 100 players. Elsewhere, a faculty representative asked professors to change the grades of failing student athletes. By the late 1980s, when college sports faced a series of high-profile academic abuses, faculty representatives were criticized for not exerting more control. A 1989 report by the Knight Commission on Intercollegiate Athletics singled them out for falling down on the job. Quote, some faculty athletic representatives have not fulfilled their potential as guardians of the academic interest. Their task is to help ensure that our institutional representatives to the NCAA are not confused about their purpose, end quote. More than 20 years later, the Chronicle reports that many still lack clarity about their role. According to a 2008 report by the Faculty Athletics Representatives Association, nearly 40% of its Division I members still do not have a formal job description, which goes against NCAA guidelines. And many say they receive little training. Faculty athletics representative is also a bit of a misnomer. Barely half of Division I-A faculty representatives were appointed with approval of a campus faculty governance body. Instead, they were simply put in place by presidents or chancellors. According to the research published in a forthcoming issue of the Journal of Intercollegiate Sport, that alienates some from their faculty constituencies, keeping them largely beholden to their administrators. In the same issue of the Chronicle is another story, a very moving account of the faculty representative who did change grades at the behest of coaches. It's a terrific story of the ambiguity that people find themselves in at the academy when saddled with a new position. Finally, after cases on deans, athletics, faculty, let's close on development and students. In yet again, another issue, just again last month in the Chronicle of Higher Education. In an effort to spur gifts among young soon-to-be alumni, students at two Ivy League institutions are trying a different approach, publicizing the names of seniors who don't contribute to their class gift. With lists, this is the best part, with lists supplied by college administrators, student volunteers at Dartmouth College and Cornell University circulated the names of students who had not donated to senior gift drives. The programs relied on students to single out their peers to meet high participation goals. I could give you other stories. The student loan subsidy scandal of 2007, the fallout from the Virginia Tech tragedy, the anticipated fallout from the freshman Rutgers suicide, college drinking, neighbors, plagiarism, grading, athletics, education, sexual harassment. These introductory cases, however, help us to recognize that these stories are just the recent tip of the iceberg. In light of this material, I ask this evening, how do we develop a culture of awareness among faculty, students, staff, and administrators that the university is a community of highly relational persons who ought to realize consciously that for us to flourish as such, we need to be aware of the integral and constitutive role of ethics? Or more briefly, why and how should a university seek to develop a role for academic ethics, inasmuch as the role, as I will now argue, is largely non-existent? To develop this argument, I offer three preliminary comments. First, I derived the title of this talk, actually I stole it, the title of this talk from Harvard's Parkman, Professor of Divinity and Professor of Comparative Theology and Director of the Center for the Study of World Religions, Francis Clooney. When the Church in the 21st Century was first launched at Boston College in 2002, Frank quipped, "I think we should sponsor a project called The University in the 21st Century." As you will see, many lessons learned from Church 21, or C21, I apply to University of the 21st Century, or U21. Frank subsequently pursued this idea in an analogous way by gathering a group of Jesuits together in an extended seminar to explore what scholarship, identity, and vocation meant to Jesuits working at Jesuit universities at the beginning of the 21st century. Among the participants were Roger Haight, James Bernauer, Arthur Madigan, Bruce Morrill, Frank, and myself. Eventually, eight of the members published essays in a collection that Frank edited entitled Jesuit Postmodern, Scholarship, Vocation, and Identity in the 21st Century. Had I submitted an essay to that collection, I would like to think it would be this one. Second, I recently chaired a conference in Trent for 600 theological ethicists from 75 countries. In reflecting on it afterwards, I understood something about my own vocation as a theological ethicist. We ethicists are, in our nature, critical. Our vocation is based on the premise that we are needed because things are not as good as they could be. If they were, you wouldn't need us, or we wouldn't need to be here. As the critics and reformers of society and church, we seek to bridge practically the gulf between who we are and who we could be. For us, then, we are always beginning with the premise that there is a deficit in our location, and therefore we need together to find a way of improving. Often, when church leaders, and now maybe when university administrators, hear presentations by ethicists, they wonder, why are we not more positive? I get this question all the time. But we cannot be more positive. By nature, we are teleologists. We are aiming at a better future. We ethicists believe that we must find the truth, and in part that means naming what is lacking, not yet seen, nor understood, nor articulated. It also means being aware of those not heard, rejected, oppressed, or abandoned. We are called to read the signs of the times as they actually are, yet still we are not an unhappy lot of naysayers. On the contrary, to do what we do, we need to listen, dream, imagine, cajole, and laugh at ourselves. Anticipating discord and hoping for better outcomes, we are fairly resilient and affable. Still, I can imagine what you members of the university community, particularly those faculty and administrators, might think of my comments here. You might wish me to be more positive. Third, during the sex abuse crisis, I frequently noted the absence of ethics in the church. So did Steve Pope here. Ethics was not only lacking, obviously, among the predatory priests, but it was also noticeably absent in the decision-making by bishops and their counselors as they transferred such priests, as they failed to notify civil authorities, as they stonewalled and defamed the reputations of concerned and aggrieved parents, and as they left children at profound risk. But ethics was also not evident even after the harm was done. As the crisis unfolded, innocent priests were not protected, due process was often breached, financial mismanagement frequently occurred, lay initiatives were treated with scorn, and priests who protested episcopal mismanagement became targeted. Why was ethics so absent? Why didn't anyone in clerical or episcopal life ask the simple question, but is it ethical? Did they have the language, the structure, and the practices to even ask, let alone answer the question, but is this ethical? I found that unlike many other professions, religious leaders rarely turned to ethical norms to consider what constitutes right conduct in their field of leadership and service. I do not mean by this that religious leaders or their decisions were or are always unethical. Rather, I mean that when religious clergy and bishops exercise routine decision-making, they turn to a multitude of considerations, but articulated ethical norms, their specific values and goods, the virtues and the type of critical thinking that estimates the long-standing social claims that these values, goods, and virtues have on us, are not explicitly professionally engaged. In a word, ethical norms, critical ethical reasoning, and their attendant ethical practices, which frequently aid other professionals in law, in business, in medicine, in counseling, in nursing, and yes, even in politics, have played a much less explicit role in the past in ecclesial leadership practices. This question, but is it ethical, arises not only in matters about sexual boundaries, but also with financial responsibility, personal and social accountability, the claims of confidentiality, the importance of truth-telling, due process, consultation, contracts, fair wages, delations, adequate representation, appeals, conflicts of interest, etc. Mandating ethical training and subsequent ethical accountability ought not to be seen, then, as inimical to the interest of the church or her mission, but rather constitutive of it. As Yale University Wayne Meeks notes, making morals means making community. So why was there so little professional ethical insight within the leadership practices and lives of our clergy and episcopacy? I offer two answers. These answers are directly connected to the hypothesis that I'm going to propose subsequently. In a way, U21 follows C21. The more immediate answer is that seminarians, religious men and women, lay leaders and bishops were not and had not been trained in professional ethics. Before the crisis, there's no evidence that anyone was trained in professional ethics. That happens, of course, today. Until recently, those who studied at seminaries, divinity schools, or schools of theology rarely had the type of ethical training that those in most other professional schools receive. Persons admitted to business, medical, nursing, or law schools take ethics courses that address specifically the ethical issues that are relevant to their particular profession. Those students are taught the responsibilities and rights specific to their profession, whether these deal with matters of representation, confidentiality, client expectations, privileges, promotions, evaluations, conflict of interest, or professional boundaries. Their ethics courses in their professional schools aim to shape, if not the students' internal dispositions, then at least the students' external conduct, so as to become acceptable colleagues in their particular professional field. Subsequent to this education, they join professional organizations which establish minimal codes of ethical conduct for their members. They become, too, part of accountability structures. Until only recently, this type of professional ethical training and accountability then was not found in most seminaries, divinity schools, or schools of theology, even though many students took 2, 3, or 4 courses of ethics. What were they studying? What we find instead was that their courses dealt with the sex lives of the laity, the social ethics of businesses, and the medical ethics of physicians and nurses. That is, those in ministry were taught how to govern and assist and make more morally accountable the members of the congregation with regard to their sexual lives, as well as being able to make claims about those in the medical and business profession. But generally speaking, they were not taught by what ethical reasoning, insights, or norms they should be held morally accountable as ministers, priests, or bishops. They had no training in the keeping of confidences, on making assignments, on professional evaluations, on the relevance of truth-telling, on crisis management, etc. Moreover, in this hierarchical structure in which priests live, their accountability was solely to the man upstairs. That is, a priest or a bishop's professional accountability was singularly vertical, but again, that man upstairs probably had no training in fairness or any other professional ethical standard. Thus, a priest basically was responsible to nothing but the bishop's own expectations and judgments. Quite apart from the absence of any ethical standards guiding the bishop's evaluation of his priest and bishops, of his priests, religious, and lay ministers, there do not seem to be any specific normative guidelines that guided bishops in their assessment of their diocesan personnel. Moreover, this vertical accountability was singularly unidirectional. This is all the studies that went on in light of the crisis about what preceded the crisis. And there was this enormous question about how much training people had in professional ethics and what were the accountability structures and how were they made to be ethical. And they found that there were enormous lacunae, which the church has been addressing ever since. Furthermore, there was and remains, though, very little horizontal accountability in this very clerical world. The priest is not accountable, so I've been talking about vertical accountability, now horizontal. There was and remains very little horizontal accountability in this very clerical world. The priest was not accountable to fellow priests, the pastor was not accountable to fellow pastors. There's no accountability to lay leaders, even parish council presidents, unless the pastor freely chooses to do so. In the absence of even the most minimal horizontal accountability, there is simply the unilateral vertical move to the man upstairs. Let me add that I am not talking only about the diocesan structures. I think religious orders have similar problems, and for this reason I have written as an ethicist of the Jesuits and their and other religious regarding their use of evaluations for those in formation, what we Jesuits infelicitously call informationes, defending the confidentiality of religious who undergo counseling and or psychological therapy from intruding superiors, and the compulsory testing of candidates for the priesthood to HIV testing. These are all by religious orders. I bring up this issue of the absence of professional ethics and clerical training and the singular vertical accountability structure of church governance because I think there is one other institutional culture that also fails to make professional ethics a part of their mode of proceeding, and that is the academy. As in the clerical world, a few of those in the academic world actually teach ethics, as I do. But I teach it for business, nursing, medical, and legal ethics courses. We teach ethics that bear on the life of other professionals, but not on our professional lives. No one studies ethics for the academy. No one takes or offers courses on academic ethics. None of us in the academy are really trained to be ethical in the standards we use for grading papers, for seeing students, for maintaining office hours, for evaluating colleagues or prospective hires. We have not been taught anything about professional confidentiality or boundaries with our students or keeping our contracts. We have not really addressed the fact that our salaries are disproportionate among one another or that tenure decisions sometimes lack what should we call objectivity. We do not have professional questions about our investments, our budgets, and our boards of directors. Moreover, like the clergy, our accountability is fundamentally vertical to our chairs and deans, but not to one another, certainly not to our students, not to the university community, nor to stipulated community standards. Similarly, our academic administrators are, like church administrators, they are rarely professionally trained as administrators. That's a remarkable truth. You know, people in other fields are trained in for administration, but in the academy, they are rarely trained as administrators, and they have, generally speaking, no more training in the ethics of academic administration than those who are answerable to them. Rather, many, if not most, academic administrators come from the faculty and often return to the faculty. You can think of recent deans and other leaders, chairs certainly. Moreover, like the clergy, faculty have few structures of horizontal accountability. Not surprisingly then, Boston College might be better prepared to address the topic of U21 since we have already been sponsoring C21. There are more similarities than we might want to acknowledge. In order to appreciate the divide between the academy's perceived need for professional ethics as opposed to the other professional fields, let us consider simply the holdings of the Boston College Library. If you enter medical ethics as a subject under which a book is filed, there are 1,321 books in our library on medical ethics. If you enter medical ethics as a keyword found anywhere in the book's description, there are 2,363 such books. If you enter business ethics as a subject, there are 597 books, but for keywords, there are 845 books. For nursing ethics, there are 296 subjects, and for keywords in nursing ethics, there are 500 such books. For legal ethics, there are 129 books under the title of subject. Under keyword entries, there are 1,487 books that deal with legal ethics. For clergy ethics, however, there are no subject entries, though there are 111 keyword entries. For academic ethics, there are no subject entries and only 19 keyword entries. Thus, while 2,363 books concern medical ethics, 1,487 books concern legal ethics, and 845 describe the much derided business ethics, only 19 mention academic ethics in the entire Boston College collection. This is even more alarming inasmuch as academics, more than business people, nurses, doctors, and lawyers, like to publish books. Our métier and promotional mantra is publishing, much more than the other professional fields. But apparently we have very little interest in professional academic ethics. Still, there are signs of hope. In a new book published 2 months ago, entitled The Ethical Challenges of Academic Administrators, the authors begin their introduction noting that their book is, quote, intended as a first word, not the final word on the subject. They add, this is the case in part because the practical activity of academic administration has not been the subject of much sustained ethical reflection. This is by the authors. They refer to two earlier works, Rudolf Weingartner's Moral Dimensions of the Academic Administration, 1999, and Paul Allskamp's Moral Leadership and the Presidency, 2003, both published by Roman and Littlefield. Weingartner makes the astute observation that there is no profession of academic administrators. The careers of most academic administrators begin in particular academic disciplines. As a result, he concludes with two questions. What prepares a faculty member for the ethical challenges that come with these career changes? Then, what indeed are the sorts of ethical challenges one is likely to face? The answer to the first question, he writes, seems to be that there is no special preparation. The answer to the second question is typically learned the hard way, by finding oneself entangled in ethical problems, often taken by surprise. This seems to be so whether we are talking about chairs, deans, vice presidents, or even presidents. One essay that captures the experience of an interim dean, entitled On the Dark Side, Lessons Learned as Interim Dean, the author writes, quote, "An interim dean will learn the sad fact that there are faculty members who are not as interested in student learning as they are in their own personal commitments. These faculty members may be consistently late to class or refuse to make any contribution in terms of service to the department. They may fail to keep current in their disciplines or neglect to update their course materials. Even worse, they may have inappropriate relationships with their students or otherwise violate student rights." In another essay, Randall Curran from the University of Rochester enunciates his cardinal virtues of academic administration: the commitment to the good of the institution, good administrative judgment, and conscientiousness in discharging those duties. In light of these virtues, he names the corresponding vices or kinds of failure of integrity in academic administration. He calls these failures in personal integrity in carrying out the duties of one's office, abuses and misuses of the powers of one office, and failures to protect and promote the integrity of the institution. There are two other books that are quite helpful in the field of ethics. In Crisis on Campus, Confronting Academic Misconduct, Wilfried Deco takes a case of plagiarism in a dissertation and completely unfolds the case. Detection, analysis, reporting, and handling, and prevention. It's a great study. Another is a long book that came out 25 years ago, Stephen Kahn's. It was originally published in 1986, and it's just been re-edited in time for a 25th anniversary issue. I find it as a worthy companion to the Academic Administrator's book because it focuses not on administration, but teaching, entitled Saints and Scamps, Ethics in the Academy. Kahn considers in one chapter teaching, including the art of instruction, examination, grades, and evaluating teaching. In another chapter, he reflects on the morality of scholarship and departmental obligations. Another concerns personnel decisions, such as faculty appointments, tenure, voting procedures, and faculty dismissals. It concludes on graduate education. These three books, really, I found the only helpful ones that have yet been published. There is, though, one other noteworthy source, the Journal of Academic Ethics. Have you ever heard of it? It's been in existence since 2003. It cast the net very broadly. Started in 2003, in its inaugural issue, it offered itself, quote, to provide a venue for dialogue for ethical issues facing the university in the 21st century. The first issue raised matters from academic freedom to tenure and faculty strikes. Since then, it has published articles on ethics and grade inflation, the modes of conducting human research, monitoring academic journals for unethical practices, among other topics. In the most recent issue of the journal, there's an essay which studies which approaches to ethics have more impact on students in terms of dissuading them from cheating. In the same issue is another essay entitled, Have Ethical Perceptions Changed? A Comparative Study on the Ethical Perceptions of Turkish Faculty Members. This was a study done twice in 2003 and 2008 of faculty perceptions regarding ethical dilemmas related to instruction, research, and outside employment opportunities. According to the findings of the study, most Turkish professors find that things are getting more unethical. We have seen then that there is a need for professional academic ethics, but we have also seen that there are resources for engaging the topic. I want to turn now to two other issues. First, since we probably cannot recall much actual discourse on ethics in the academy, what practices might we look for in a university in order to promote this discourse. That is, what practices do we need so as to develop a more hospitable climate and culture for academic ethics? Secondly, if we were to develop those practices, what would or could discourse on academic ethics look like at such a university? I want to return to Wayne Meek's insight and say that making morals means making community. Of course, this is a claim that resonates with the teachings of Aristotle and certainly those of Jesus. I want to argue here that we can get to ethics in one of two ways. We can have regulatory requirements coming from the top down, that is, from the man upstairs, sending us notices regarding disclosure, ethical norms for teaching, research, salaries, office hours, modes of grading, etc. Or we can build the university into a community that in its nature looks to the ethical as constitutive for its flourishment. Now, I know that being Catholic, I might endorse a both-and approach, but here I want to attend to the building up of community by ethical practices, and there are four ethical practices that I name here: greater transparency, community building, horizontal accountability, and more accountable structures of vertical accountability. First, there are a number of practices that promote transparency on university campuses, which I believe promote true community building. Let me begin, though, with a premise. If we think of a university as a community of persons seeking wisdom and understanding, then we ought to get to know those persons. Fortunately, we are moving away from what I call an older, the anonymous idea of the university as a place where ideas are shared and explored. It was in that model that I grew up taking courses more for the course title than for the professor teaching it. For instance, one semester, when I was a doctoral student at the Gregorian University in Rome, I saw that there was a course being offered on Erasmus. I told about eight of my peers that we should all think of taking that course. I was that way then, too. Everyone told me, but Father so-and-so was teaching it, and I hear he's awful. How awful can he be, I replied. After all, we are not learning him, but Erasmus. How could he harm Erasmus? After the first 2 hours of class, we all dropped the course. Then and there, I realized that I was changing. I no longer thought that education was learning ideas. Now I understood education as learning ideas from someone. Getting to know that someone is, I think, one of the major developments of the 21st century. What practices promote transparency? I think the posting of faculty evaluations is a major breakthrough in actually guiding students to their professors. Though there are admittedly a lot of subjective stances conveyed that might be bias-driven, still, I think faculty evaluations help to introduce students to faculty whose evaluations, whose teaching they evaluate. Conversely, I think that faculty posting their syllabi are another set of practices that help professors to actually advertise their interests and ways of proceeding. I also find that student newspapers and university newspapers are helpful for understanding better the university. For instance, I love the weekly police blotter in the Heights. I read it faithfully. It's the first thing I read all the time. If you see me in the Rexplex, I'm reading the police blotter. I love it. I get a sense of what we really have as challenges to safety and security here. It's one of the great gestures of transparency on this university that we know who got arrested and why. Well, we don't know who, but we know that they got arrested and why. I too like the new initiative where there's now the additional neighborhood police blotters that is there. This is a new development, a happy one. The academic setting is not used to such transparency. Confidentiality and secrecy is maintained on matters of hiring, promotions, tenure, appointments, disciplining, etc. I think finding more transparent practices would increase our community building. Community building is at a university is not easy. We faculty work alone. We teach alone, basically. And then when we work together, we work in departments. And when we work in departments, we are separated by schools. At the conference sponsored last Saturday by the Institute for Liberal Arts, Harvard's Louis Menand spoke on the singular nature of the academic discipline. If you heard him, you would certainly see how challenging it is to go and build a community at a university where departments and schools have their own distinctive modes of proceeding. But what are community building practices at today's universities? Well, one set of practices are festive. The freshman convocation here at Boston College is an enormously important development, as has been the tradition, hopefully now that the economy has changed, of Christmas parties here. The provost initiative to get faculty to both Parents Weekend and especially to get faculty to participate in and attend at least the commencement exercises strike me as very helpful for promoting community. The incentive to prompt faculty to host dinners for their students is another development. What are more distinctively academic practices that promote community building? One set of such practices promote forms of interdisciplinarity. Here at Boston College, the Jesuit Institute has sponsored faculty seminars that promote interdisciplinary dialogue. Through the Jesuit Institute, T. Frank Kennedy sponsors a colloquium called Junior Scholars in Conversation. Every month, some 12 to 15 not yet tenured faculty come together for dinner and to listen from our ranks one who delivers a presentation on her or his research. We've been doing it for years. It's a great success, and all junior faculty are invited. Joe Appleyard's enormous contribution at the Intersection Seminar has helped faculty, administrators, and staff to get to know one another while getting to know the university. The newly formed Institute for Liberal Arts now enters its second year under Mary Crane's direction, helping to promote the liberal arts precisely through interdisciplinarity. There are other sets of practices that build community. Recently, our theology department worked out a mission statement, and that practice helped, I think, to solidify our work with one another. The work of intersections, campus ministry, and student affairs have promoted innumerable activities for students and students with faculty, whether in halftime, retreats, immersion programs, or other events. But nothing is as formidable as faculty mentoring students, an insight developed just this week in the annual Gasson Lecture by Father Thomas Buckley. Here I have found, in particular, the undergraduate research fellowship to be a mutually beneficial mode of mentoring. Say that three times fast. There are, though, major challenges ahead of us, and among many, I think, is the divide between the work of student life and the work of faculty. We need to bridge that divide between student life and academic life. Here, I think we could simply begin by asking faculty, do they know what the words voûte, chevres, maderos, and katska have in common? Do you? I'll take some water. Maybe faculty orientations at all universities could include the practice of tours of student dorms, counseling and advising centers, employment and clubs offices. We need more practices that bridge the divide between dorm and classroom lives. These are two distinct lives at most university campuses, and faculty don't know where to go, and the student administration people do not know how to talk with the faculty on these matters. Finally, we also need to build more community among all the employees of the university. There are a variety of ways that staff and faculty who work side by side need to find more ways to build community side by side. One practice might be developed by departmental chairs and assistant chairs, finding ways to demonstrate and celebrate the fact that all the employees in a given department exercise the mission of that department. A greater consciousness awareness of such possible practices strikes me as foundational. As we ascend, however, these practices that build in accountability while building community are even more challenging. For instance, the third set of practices regarding horizontal accountability are enormously important for making sure that the university is not simply a set of silos or disparate disciplines. I think our promotion and tenure committees are the great model of horizontal accountability. I know if you're not yet tenured, you may think I am a horrible person. But I think also university-wide curriculum committees, faculty grievance committees, and university-wide and departmental educational policy committees and the like are also helpful practices for greater horizontal accountability. But I think we need more and other accountable, horizontally accountable practices so as to promote greater cooperation and transparency. A great step forward for any university would be to establish school-wide committees to do post-tenure and post-promotion reviews. Several years ago, I received a letter notifying me that as the holder of an endowed chair, I would be subject to a review by the provost office every 5 years. I was astonished. I thought I'd never be evaluated again. I kept that letter. I don't know where I put it, but I've kept it. I think this is a great step forward, but I also think we need some horizontal structures of accountability, and nothing strikes me as more urgent than a university-wide post-tenure review committee. Quite apart from the entire question of tenure's validity, we need to find ways of making ourselves as tenured faculty accountable. And I do not think that a simple vertical accountability practice is sufficient. We could also have other horizontal accountability structures. For instance, do the boards of chairs meet in schools? Do they make any collective decisions? I mean, I haven't seen any instance of that. Do the board of deans make collective decisions? They may consult, they may talk, they may meet. Do they make collective decisions? Who at the university does the horizontal oversight of the differences in salaries, incremental benefits, gender and race disparities, or the ever-expanding issue of adjunct hires and the matters of justice that there need to be addressed? Finally, when it comes to the vertical accountability structures, one has to ask, what practices would help us to build further accountability, transparency, and community building into the structures of the university's vertical accountability? We need vertical accountability. For instance, boards of chairs and boards of deans are terribly relevant to university life in assisting deans and provosts to be accountable as they insist on accountability. Similarly, university-wide committee advisory committees for deans, provosts, and presidents can also make vertical accountability structures more humane, more ethical, and more integral to community building. But in all these instances, there must be greater transparency, especially through providing accessible records. These are but some practices that I believe are integral to realizing the claim that making morals means making community. But let me conclude now on the point of discourse in academic ethics. I have argued this evening that building community is congruent with building ethics, but I want to add that inasmuch as we are a university, we ought to learn something about the language of ethics. I found it fascinating that at the ILA seminar on Saturday, Catherine Stimson commented that in one of her never published essays, she had proposed that the first year of graduate studies in every university ought to be dedicated to academic ethics. I think that would be a great project. But I have to ask, what language would we use for it? Kantian deontological? Catholic deontological? Catholic proportional? utilitarian values, human rights language, rights and responsibility language, radical feminist language, contextual language. I want to propose to you a closing, more simple and familiar language that we use to build community. That is the language of virtue. Accepting my offer, you might ask, well, which virtues? And so let me in turn offer you four: justice, fidelity, self-care, and prudence. The call for justice is the call for fairness for all, the call to secure for each their due. Regardless of our relatedness to one another, we believe that justice seeks equity impartially. As justice secures equality and demands impartiality, we have specific relationships that demand partiality. We are specifically to be faithful to our own set of parents, to our one mother, our one father, to our family, to our friends and neighbors. To them, we are called to be faithful. Similarly, at a university, we are called to be loyal to fellow employees, specific partners, identifiable students, departmental colleagues, and supportive staff. Finally, we also have responsibilities to our very selves, to take care of ourselves physically, emotionally, socially, spiritually, and ethically. Still, since the time of Antigone, we have realized that the claims of virtue are not necessarily complementary in the here and now. Thus, we need the fourth virtue, prudence, not only to understand what justice, fidelity, and self-care might require of us in the here and now, but also to arbitrate among these virtues. Thus, we might have to ask ourselves whether the call for justice for some students, for instance, might in this instance trump the call for fidelity to, say, university benefactors or even to the school's mission. But I've come to the point where the virtue of prudence cries out in an academic setting for relief. And thus I close noting, saying simply, that even though I may have exhausted you with all the ethical challenges that ought to be faced by a university community, let me leave you with this. I never mentioned other issues that directly touch campus life. I never said anything about sustainability on campus, unions on campus, relations with neighbors, students' rights, sexual health issues, board of trustees' terms of office, conflict of interest laws, workers' benefits, immigration issues, racial tensions, classism, to name a few. I do hope that nevertheless I have given you a presentation of why and how a university community must think of professional academic ethics and its attendant practices. I hope, too, that I have left you wondering enough, so much so that you might begin occasionally to look at a university practice or rule and ask simply, but is it ethical? Thank you.
We have 20-ish minutes or so for questions, and Father Keenan will take this right off.
We might just want to take a little pause for a moment, drink a little water. Yes.
That we see all across from the bottom. I see St. Ignatius, when he started the Jesuit schools and all, he insisted that there be no tuition fees at all for the students. So the question I have, is it ethical the way these tuition fees are going up?
Well, your question is just a part of, I mean, your question is first that there was a tradition by a particular religious order that made a practice of educating without a fee. And then it realized it needed to, in some instances, charge a fee, then charge a tuition, then escalate in tuition, and now we are here at Boston College. But that's also related to a variety of other questions about fairness and fees at a university. You know, I mean, there are a variety of questions about What about the endowments that universities have, and how much are they used in order to support or not support tuition reductions or, you know, escalations? That there's, I mean, your question is just one that you could do a course on called tuition fees, you know? And I mean, if you look at our course offerings, you'll see that we manage to go in depth on a number of issues, but we don't go in depth on courses that are germane to the academic life, like charging fees. Like, I mean, a number of people say, how can we have graduate students that maybe we're not charging fees, we're giving stipends to, but we bring them in, do they get jobs subsequently? This is the whole question of income, the question of outcome. These are very big ethical questions. And they are questions that lead us to ask, but is it ethical? Yes, Ray. Well, I do think like the step that our faculty evaluations are now online changes a lot of things for us and for the students. It would be very interesting if subsequently we have something of, you know, professors' evaluations of administrators. After we got into the habit of doing that, we would have to first figure out how to do that. We could publish them. We would have transparency, but I do think that as we gain in practices that I think are important for not just transparency, but for building community and for building it ethically, the more we get into the practice of such practices, the more we can expand our own imagination about the modes of proceeding elsewhere. I don't have, you know, I've been thinking of it's really wild looking at this Journal of Academic Ethics. They began very well, but then they got into safe studies. You know, they got into these studies, what do the Turkish professors say, and what do people in Bahia think of, you know, early class release time, and, you know, they got into a lot of studies thing, which I think became safe, rather than exploratory things about what could be done to bring academic ethics into the university. Right.
BC is well aware of it. Other universities have the problem too. And part of it is that it is fueled by secrecy about salary.
Right.
So that it's very difficult to actually try to enforce any particular claim. Nobody could really do anything about it. And so when you think about, well, you know, BC is a place that aspires to be an ethical place, aspires to do right by its constituents, and would think would want to address an issue like this, and yet on a overturning so many various norms that we have, it seems like in practical terms it's a real challenge.
Right. Yeah, I agree. And as a matter of fact, you know, when you read the Chronicle of Higher Ed and all, you know, if you read it the way I do it, you know, pathologically, where I'm looking for all these problems which excite me, you realize that there is no systematic approach to this. The Chronicle is just giving you faculty reps, they're giving you deans, they're giving you this story, they're giving you that story, but there's no pullback to ask, what does the Academy need to do? And the one thing is, because of our mode of proceeding, the question of the professional ethical does not enter into it. If we are seeing, however, you know, like those articles that I mentioned, or more importantly, some of the books in the journal, we're seeing more and more interest in that. You know, just my talk tonight, I think, is indicative of something that's on the verge of emerging. and that maybe it will be interesting to see how different universities try to move forward in incorporating academic ethics into the university. I was struck. I remember when I first finished my degree, I came back to the States, and I had learned, I don't know whether it was from Mark Masso or someone else, an American historian, that American university presidents taught the ethics classes at their universities. I thought that, that's right, Steve? Yeah. That's an enormous legacy that should be revisited. You know, that, and that the ethics being taught should be pertinent to the life of the university. I think that the more we start talking about it, the more we will, as professors, use our own skills, whether in education, in history, in ethics, in law, to in management, to look at how we proceed with our own skills and bring them to expression. That's why I did this lecture, as a catalyst for other departments and schools to engage it, and to think imaginatively and almost horizontally, to be on the lookout for where other universities are trying to face the same issues. Yes?
You mentioned the rift or even the chasm between faculty on the one hand and student life on the other. And you only mentioned a couple possible
ways. Oh, yeah. Well, I think even in the classroom, it's very hard in the class, if we don't know student life, it's very hard to bring up student life in the classroom. And, you know, I think when I see, like, intersections manage to get faculty like myself more connected with other offices around the university and to introduce me to other faculty around the university, I think we need to figure out other ways of understanding better the universe. For instance, I go and I talk to student life people regularly about sexual ethics and sexual guidelines and the notion of virtue and, you know, how these approaches might be constructive and positive for talking about sexual responsibility in the dorms, all right? They come, in turn, telling me these stories that I can't repeat here. But there's enough of a life that's complicated that faculty are not that familiar with unless they have particular relationships with particular students who bring it up in the classes. They tend to bring it up in ethics classes, but then again, people who are taking ethics classes may be more prone to that than the ones who really need to bring it up who are not in those ethics classes. So there's a catch-22 in all this of how can we learn more. I do think that if faculty understood something about dorm life, I remember being so struck, you know, that awful experience of that freshman at Rutgers, you know. I want to know how much taping of one another happens, you know. How much channeling happens? How much privacy does a person have? I think growing up at 17 or 18, your first year away into maturation in a dorm is bizarre. You know, it'd be very interesting to think what will universities be like when academics ask how ethical is dorm life, period. A book on that would be nice, but we don't have anything on. What we have instead are student affairs people who are trying to deal with the given of student life in the dorms. The dorm is a given. How can the university think ethically? How can we have housing for our students in a creative way that promotes community building with faculty, staff, and administrators in a way that's reflective of the 21st century? So again, I'm just opening, I mean, I could go on any of these topics because I've been thinking of it and tried to just consolidate it into one type, but you know, here we are. I was so struck by antimatter yesterday. Wasn't that exciting? I mean, I'm driving. I stopped the car. That they captured antimatter for 0.6 seconds. But it was fascinating, this thing. This enormous, you know, we can capture antimatter. Well, what can we do? Capture a dorm and just explore the ethics of life in the dorm. How many students I worked as a, my first professional job in ministry was as a deacon, a minister at Harvard University in the Social Justice Committee. And I remember, you know, calling and hearing people screaming on in the background. And I would ask, what is that noise? And they said, exam times. I said, what do you mean exam times? And they said, well, some people have a lot of stress right now. Well, I mean, do we understand what is breaking point in student life in the dorms? So there is a way that the university faculty have been protected in their classrooms from understanding the actual lives of students. I say to faculty, set one Thursday night at about 11 p.m. and go to St. Ignatius Church and sit there and ask yourself about those cabs. And then come back at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning and see people beginning to return on Thursday night. I don't think most faculty know the practice of catching a cab on Thursday nights in front of St. Ignatius Church. I do because I live here, and I coming back at 12 o'clock, I'm amazed at the queue. There's some practices here that faculty know very little about. But our structures, and it goes to Ray's issue, our structures are simply, in a way, preventative of our understanding how the other half lives. And in this case, it's not a question of class, but a question of roles. I said, that young woman on the stair there. Yes. Yeah, I think that in order to even talk about a discipline called academic ethics, we have to stand back and ask what's its purview, what is its field of inquiry. But we're not starting from scratch. You know, first, like I just used that example of the fact that university presidents, Harvard University, these, you know, in, going back to colonial times, people were teaching as presidents, the ethics to the students at the university. That was the job of the president's relationship to the students. So I think we have a legacy that needs to be re-examined. I also think, though, we can use some of the skills in our own fields to imagine appropriate ways of developing this field. I think, too, we can find out what other universities are doing and not see ourselves as a silo in the field of academic ethics. So in order to develop academic ethics, we do have plenty of resources. We need to think, though, again, what Ray said, what are the structures that may impede us from raising some of those questions? Steve?
So I know you're very, I love the talk, thank you. And the question I have is, how does solidarity and concern for people off the campus?
Yeah.
How do we think about that in the future? Because we have programs here and we have a lot of sympathetic people, but how do we move solidarity into this framework you've given us?
Yeah, I really don't know. I mean, right now, I was thinking this morning that one way that Newton kind of incorporates us more and more is they put parking meters for parking on Beacon Street. So they've decided that maybe we're a bother, but at least we can be paying while we're bothering. So, there are a lot of constructive ways of proceeding, but I wonder, what is the extent that any of us who are here, faculty, staff, or a few administrators, understand what are the issues of the community? Other than parking at football games. You know, that's what captures our imagination. But I don't know what they really are. I don't know how much of the housing off campus is actually problematic for the neighborhood or if it's a source of revenue for the neighborhood. I don't know any of these things, but I think that many of us don't know, like myself, much about the outside the environs, the neighbors. You do see, though, like in the Journal of Academic Ethics and mentioned often in the Chronicle, articles about particular universities having difficult relations with their neighbors. Is that what you're referring to?
I wasn't so much thinking about the solidarity with Newton, but more solidarity with Roxbury.
Oh, yeah.
Well,
but that's, yes, I think that we're very good at learning about justice elsewhere. I think that, and that goes to the young woman's question, that, you know, it may be good about the immersion programs that we have that help students to understand better the experiences in El Salvador or in Haiti or elsewhere, or Appalachia, that there be some sort of other ways that we actually try to see what about, you know, issues of justice or problems that are here, you know. We reflect externally. You know, our inquiries about, you know, here I'm looking at you, I'm looking at Don, people who really lead a lot of the students. It'd be interesting to see what you think would be ways of leading faculty and administrators and staff to know what the challenges are for one another. That's why I'm interested in community building, which I think requires some sort of better familiarity with how others live. I just took over the graduate program. I never, in the theology department, I never knew, you know, things about leaves of absence and whether you get medical health insurance and whether you don't, or who does and who doesn't. I never knew how long a leave was. I never knew when things were due. Most of us don't know these things. That's why they have the director of the graduate program harping on everybody to get things in. But there's a lot that I'm learning about the needs of graduate students that after I directed, you know, like 25 doctoral students. I've been the director, 25 doctoral students. I never learned in that work really what the more immediate problem, I mean, I would know if a student had a problem that they couldn't get work in, or they were having a hard time, or there was a problem in their marriage, or the problem in a pregnancy, or something like that. But I didn't know the enduring issues that are part of the ordinary texture of graduate student lives until I became director of the graduate. There's a certain way that, of course, this is to be understood, but there are other issues and ways of communicating that and fora for that that are simply not there. Yet we do know a lot about the structures of other, you know, other social structures elsewhere. Yes, Paul. Yeah. Yeah, I don't think that there, I don't think that the way of looking at academic ethics should have a particular order. I think that initiatives taken by students, I think, you know, students talking about sexual health and students talking about pro-life, students bringing these things up, and sometimes they're complementary, sometimes they're contrary to one another. It's interesting to see how they're bringing ethical claims to the university. But I'm wondering, again, it goes to your question, how does that relate to faculty engaging that outside of the classroom? And how does it emerge in the classroom as part of the work that students are trying to do or other initiatives? I don't think that many students know of initiatives that faculty take. I mean, that's why I think community building is very important to this project. That as a matter of fact, the more we know one another, the better we have of community, the more we will be in dialogue across these different disciplines. I was very negatively struck by Louis Menand's presentation on Saturday about the role of authority in the university as being disciplined or departmentally driven, that the norms and procedures for how things go according to the department that rolls them out. And I began to think more and more, well, how do we actually get away from that model to a more collective way of approaching? It is, I think, by fostering ways to build community. Making community means making morals. Making morals means making community. Thank you.